When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's so cold, but it's time to wind up for the gaming week. Now, you can't go a day or two without something horrible happening in the news in regards to layoffs and all sorts of different, the ground underneath us shaking. Now, I did a news on something yesterday on the amount of the state of Sony. I've been keeping up with this, and we are going to dive into various news stories, talking points across the industry. I haven't even introduced us. Going into this, shooting from the hip. I'm Scott Tilbert, that's Ewan Patterson. How are you doing?
It's really cold in here, Scott.
It is very, very cold. We're recording remotely at the minute because our own roof is being repaired at the office, so we're sort of scattered a bit. There's mold and cobwebs, and at some point Spider-Man's going to come in to deal
mold
with it.
Man.
Mold man, but not just yet. We're going to open on... I wanted to just touch on the stuff that's happening with Bungie, because that broke last night. Even though I did do a news yesterday on everything that's happening over at Sony, apparently the reality of what happened to Connie Booth was that she was fired, at least according to God of War creator David Jaffe and the sources within Sony that have talked to him. But it seems like Sony have got all this stuff going on with their push towards live services, making formerly single-player associated developers move on to multiplayer projects, and a lot of internal strife that happened with that. And then last night, at 5 p.m. UK time, it was reported by Jason Schreier that Bungie are the latest company to have a whole bunch of layoffs, including various veteran staff members, and including legendary composer Michael Salvatore, the dude that helped... I can't even think of the dude's name.
Marty O'Donnell,
do the composing over on Halo, and then Salvatore was responsible for Destiny as well. He's had to update his personal website that just says "Gone Fishing," because it seems like overall
that's the way to do it. Really,
it is. But it seems like overall these people were given very little notice ahead of time of what was going to happen. Tons of Bungie staff over on social media on Twitter just saying, has anyone got any work? Because it's very much, last-minute stuff. So, I don't know what the hell's going on with Sony. We have another news story regarding PlayStation sales to get into, but just quick thoughts on the general state of things at the minute.
It's just rotten. It really is rotten, Isn't it? I feel like how many layoffs, come out over the last couple of months? And for, like, a massive studio like Bungie, which PlayStation only bought, was it last year?
It was, apparently it's been 15 months. So yeah,
it's
year and a half.
It's just really, I can't say any other word to describe it. It might just be how grey everything is currently, how wet and miserable things feel. It's just depressing. It really is depressing that all these talented people who, you know, have been roped into this big studio apparatus, the publisher apparatus again, you'd think that they'd get extra security from that. And yet, even with profits going ridiculously well, PlayStation says, literally the other day was like, oh, we're expecting the PlayStation 5 like sales this quarter and next year to be like the best ever. It's like, even with that kind of backing and grounding, their jobs aren't safe. Like,
I just the Bungie side of things, because like obviously I haven't been with them since almost the very beginning. I never played Marathon or the original stuff that they did over on Apple computers or whatever, but like been there since the Halo days. And it's like they did all of Halo, they didn't want to do Halo Reach, and they ended up doing an extra Halo game, and then they broke away and they became independent. They did Destiny for Activision, and then apparently that was a living hell, and then they broke away from that, they became independent, but they kept the IP. And I remember the at the time it was Jason Schreier as well reporting for Kotaku that there were like pop champagne corks and cheering and celebrations that they were able to break away from the Activision model whilst keeping Destiny. And then Destiny had a way better run for a good few years, and it was like, okay, cool, you guys have your own Destiny in your hands, that's great. And then it was insane when they signed with PlayStation, and it was just like, but the assumption that you do that is obviously to fund bigger projects or whatever you want to do that you couldn't do beforehand, and then, you know, to then lose veteran staff, to then lose the people who had stuck around that long, just seems like a massive shame. I was watching Alana Pierce's breakdown of just how many people have been let go, and it's over 6,000 people across the industry at the minute, which I think she said accounts for, it might be about 30, or maybe it's less than that percent of the industry staff across this year, kind of thing, especially across the last month as well. And there are various websites now tracking this stuff, because every other day there's another story about just how many people are being let go. But it's just a shame. Like, if Bungie and Sony can't make it work, if Naughty Dog are losing contractors and then Bungie are losing staff as well, to me, it kind of shines a light on, like, yes, this has been an incredible year for gaming, but I do wonder about how much the sales are actually there. Like, how much, you know, like, let's say there's 20 must-play games this year. I don't think the average person is keeping up with even half of that. I think they're playing a fraction of that. And the only thing I have to go off is I put a tweet out just asking people, are you actually keeping up with this stuff? And most people were saying, no, I'm picking one game every sort of few weeks. And it's the same for the people that I talk to in real life as well. What's your general thoughts on that? Do you think people are actually keeping up?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're told how well games are selling in certain areas, but I think it is a case of people are being more selective. Like, you know, we're getting, like, cost of living, inflation, wages aren't appreciating as, you know, quickly as everything is inflated over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years ago, for a brand new game, you'd be looking at paying £40 or like £49.99. The absolute, like, if you were going to like some, if you weren't making a wise purchasing decision and you were going to a store that didn't have that normal kind of set benchmark or whatever. It's something that's peculiar to me, because I think we've spoken about this a lot recently, and I don't know whether this is mostly, you know, maybe a sales thing. You know, gaming is becoming an elite hobby in a great many ways. You know, to keep up with all the latest hardware, you need to have a pretty decent income to make sure that you're keeping up with stuff. I think I do wonder if this is a case of impatient investors and the fact that, you know, they are waiting so long for these returns to come through. Like, you know, gaming is a unique medium in the sense that you could literally be working on a game for close to a decade now, and that's a long time to wait for the payoff there. So I don't know what is going on right now, Scott. I think I don't think the numbers are necessarily unclear. I still think clearly there is a lot of money. Like, it's the most profitable entertainment industry on the planet.
Yeah,
you know.
True.
So to me, this is all just it's all just a little bit bizarre, and I do wonder if it's a case of the fact that things are taking so long to tick over and get to a point where a project initiated in 20 whatever becomes viable financially in 20 whatever, like however many years down the line. I don't know if that's the driving cause behind this, because the gaming industry is quite a migratory industry in and of itself. You know, developers, artists, whatever, they're constantly moving in between different studios and stuff. But this is like, these are long-term employees, foundational employees that have been around at these companies for so long. So it hints to me as there is some kind of deeper rot that isn't being addressed here. And I don't know whether it's just greed. And I don't know if it's just the fact that maybe things aren't as sustainable as we think they are. Mm. Either way, it just sucks for these people who, you know, especially people who have been with these companies for such a long time.
Well, the thing is, like, not to go, like, because it's a huge, like, talking point, it's very much omnipresent. Like, some of the things that stood out, like Media Molecule had layoffs last week, and that to some degree made a bit more sense in terms of, like, Dreams did not take off whatsoever in terms of how long that game took to put together. But then there's also, I was looking at Lamplighters League, which is on Game Pass. That's the next game from Harebrained
Schemes. I'm really jealous that Xbox,
it's really cool.
That one,
like, that's a nice little game. Like, it's like half stealth game, but then you go into a turn based sort of strategic combat, like XCOM, and it's a nice little
pulpy
tight game.
Adventure 1930s.
Yeah. And it's like that, but that had very, very little to no marketing. And it's like that was one of those like sob story kind of write-ups where it was just like they knew the game, they knew they had to have layoffs before they even hit launch because of just how badly it was all coming together across the development. And that's just such a shame. Like Harebrained are an incredible studio. And it was just one of those things where like the fact that they know it months in advance, I think is just, you know, what the hell does that feel like to work on where it's just a weird march towards the launch date or whatever. But yeah, very much an omnipresent thing. And speaking of console sales, I want to talk about this comes from a French outlet called Ludostria, who are reporting that the PS5 has outsold the combined sales of the Xbox Series S and Series X 9-1. They call the Xbox side of things catastrophic. Now this comes to, there's a Metro writer.
Catastrophic.
Catastrophic.
I had to do it. It has to be done.
As well you should. But yeah, so this is a write-up over on Metro, but the original report is from Ludostria. That's me guessing how to pronounce Ludostria as well. I think that's right. But they report on in the Ludostria report that Microsoft apparently makes very little effort to push the Xbox in France. Locals claim that Xbox marketing is almost non-existent. Apparently they put very little effort into localization overall with poorly translated games. And even the Xbox UI is now infamous amongst French fans. Metro say that they were... lucky to get French voiceovers in Starfield, as Microsoft didn't bother with an Italian dub either, despite Bethesda producing one for its previous games. So that's kind of like a whole separate story, but I think the console sales don't surprise me that much. It feels like PlayStation and Nintendo are just way far out in advance, or in the lead. But 9-1 is insane. Like, I don't really think you're going to claw that back.
No, and it's interesting that they're approaching it from that angle on localization as well, because I think that's something that we as English speakers probably don't think about a lot. Xbox, obviously the bulk of sales, like I don't know the percentages exactly, the bulk of, you know, these market sales will be in North America, will be in, you know, the United States and Canada. But it is interesting that, you know, seemingly lagging behind in other areas, and not doing localizations like that seems, again, that's the first time I've ever heard that being done. That would be a decent explanation for them losing ground. But the issue with that is if you're not doing localizations well, this is like a generational battle they're losing even more, and it's kind of got tying into that narrative that Phil Spencer kind of articulated the other month, where he was basically like, "Oh yeah, no, we lost in 2012, and then we're just gonna just keep being like," which is just stupid. I don't know. I feel like it's not at all surprising that, you know, the PlayStation brand continues to basically pummel Xbox in its sleep, the way things went with the last generation. But yeah, I don't know. It kind of ties back into these conversations that we've been having over the last few months of what does the future of Xbox look like? How are we feeling? And to just go back to that point you made on Lamplighters League, because that was a Game Pass title as well, wasn't it?
Yep.
Is this having a negative impact as well? Because, like, obviously Starfield, big game, obviously came out on Game Pass. That was, like, a huge momentum. But that is, like, a standalone thing, too. There's something like Lamplighters League. When you have Game Pass and you're just basically dumping titles on Game Pass, are we now going to have the same conversation that as a film person or kind of has with like streaming services like Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime? Are we devaluing these experiences to basically just be quote unquote content that goes onto a streaming service that we then forget about and is completely disposable? There is all sorts of different aspects of Xbox's business model currently which just do not appeal to my instincts as someone who plays video games. But obviously there must be some business sense behind it, but at the same time they seem to be conceding that everything isn't working, so I don't even know, Scott. This whole thing just kind of feels like they've gone so far down this one hole now, and they're putting more and more time into it, but as we can see from this report, it's clearly not working. And like abandoning localization, that's so bizarre.
Yeah, and that's like a whole territory that is apparently incredibly underserved. My thing is just like, where I always think of all three big players in the industry, like Nintendo, and we can talk about this as well, you can all kind of fold this in, that like their latest patents for the next Switch have apparently leaked, although it hasn't been fully confirmed yet by most more reputable sources. But it seems like the next Switch model is a two-part system that connects together. You have some portion of the system that you take with you on the go, and then you have something else that it connects to when you're back at home. Apparently they're doing away with the Switch dock, but I think it'll still have the same functionality. You'll plug it into something something that'll put it on your TV or whatever. But that's kind of Nintendo are always off on their own little island, and I always love that for. I love them for that. I love that they're just not bothered about chasing, you know, big sort of AAA over the top kind of graphical presentation stuff. We'll get more Mario, we'll get more Zelda, maybe we'll get a Star Fox, and so that's kind of interesting in terms of where they are. Sony, like I mentioned at the beginning, have all these layoffs and all this different planning stuff. It's all over the place. Where Jim Ryan was the guy saying they want to he wants to have 12 live service games in motion by 2026, and now the dude's not even going to be there to oversee any of it, and a veteran producer who was there for over 3 decades has left, assumedly or apparently, because of that decision. And so there's all that stuff. And then on the Microsoft side, the acquisition finally went through. They have Call of Duty, they have Activision, and they have all these titles to put on this monthly service. But if you can't guarantee that mid-budget stuff is even going to be seen by everybody, and you're underperforming so much in key areas or in certain areas, then that's insane in itself. Like, all we can be is commentators, but like, as a point in time and a point in gaming history, this year has been such a weird back and forward. Like, there's so much stuff that demands the spotlight, and there are so many phenomenal games this year of all different production tiers. But the layoffs are greater than they've been in the past. And it's one of those things that it just makes you wonder what the hell next year is going to look like. Does everybody calm down a bit and just focus on something else? Or do we keep trying to make these giant plays for live services and monthly services?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I feel like, again, with going back to film, it just feels like we're at a big transitional ruction point in these industries right now, the way that entertainment is being, you know, digested, how it's being made, you know. We're going to talk about AI in a little bit as well. It feels like a very bizarre time where, you know, there are a lot of successes, but it's punctuated by human misery. And then also, like, you know, just like, I don't know, Scott, I'm feeling very glum today, which probably isn't helping things in general. But
it's because our roof's falling in, mate.
Yeah, yeah. But it's just, I find this whole thing, like, it almost feels like Xbox is on autopilot right now. And it's just kind of just like, yeah. You know, yeah.
Well, the leaked stuff from Phil Spencer's emails from internally within Microsoft. Obviously, he's head of Microsoft Gaming, and then like the general conversations he was having about Xbox, and then them just sort of realizing what state Redfall was in after it launched, and just sort of the emails that came out about like Spencer saying that, what do we actually have? What are we actually leading with? And it's like, it's so ambitious, and it's so, like, in theory, it should be great to build this whole Game Pass library. We talked about it so much, and it's like, I do like the idea of someone just paying a monthly fee, and that gives you so many different games. Like, that would have been so good for us when we were younger. Like, I imagine the people who are growing up as gamers are just like, oh my God, I have so many things to play, and that's great. But it makes you wonder about the monetization model itself. And to bring it back to what you said, does it make those games feel more discardable? Like, it's so much easier to just delete something off Game Pass because you have 8 things at a time.
We talk about this quite a bit, I think. You know, as in film and in gaming, you think about how we used to make entertainment an event. Like, you would have to go into town to buy something, and it would be yours, and you would own it. Whether that would be going to Blockbuster and like getting your movies in for the weekend, or it's your birthday and you're going into town and you're going to pick up a video game for the first time, and that forges a lot of, like, it's the reason why I remember stupid nonsense like Scooby-Doo Mystery Mayhem for the Xbox, right? Because I went into town, I bought that game, I was excited to play it, I had it, I owned it, and I played it a bunch, right? Are people forging these memories anymore? Is there a whole legacy issue going on now? I'm getting very deep and existential now, Scott Telford.
No, but I think that's fair. Like, no, my thing is, like, I think you can still make those memories if it feels like a big enough event. Like, I mean, Elden Ring felt like an event. Like, that was like a big, big game. Spider-Man 2 feels like an event. That does come with, obviously, a big physical release. And you are seeing people share their collector's editions and 19 inches of Venom, etc. But I think if the game is big enough and the conversation is big enough, then it punches through and it becomes a point in time. Like I point to Elden Ring as just when everyone was talking about it. Like, every, like, casual friend I have who checks into games every now and then was asking if they should play it. And it felt like that crossed over to the mainstream. And it's, I think if it's big enough, then it crosses over. But it is that thing of just like, where we don't incentivize physical purchases, we don't incentivize anything other than just preloading and playing at midnight. And I do love that. I love the immediacy of it, but I know exactly what you mean.
It's like, it's the same thing. Like, growing up, people would be like bragging about going to the midnight launch of like the new Halo or new Call of Duty, or like, oh, waiting for the postman to get here on like launch day. Oh, is your copy coming? Yeah. But now you can just literally press a button and it downloads and it's there to play. I don't know. It's weird. I feel like, again, I'm going into a whole old man yells at cloud odd thing, but if we're talking about like going back to the localization stuff as well, like the French language is one of the biggest, most widely spoken languages on the planet, and to just discard that again, like I feel like there is a generational issue here. I mean, I'm not saying that gaming is not going to be a part of people's lives or whatever, because it's clearly, again, continues to be the most profitable, most biggest entertainment industry on the planet currently. However, it does make me kind of anxious. We've got all this new media coming in as well, which is all very disposable and stuff. How are people, what is gaming going to look like? Like,
yeah, exactly.
X many years from now? It's kind of, I don't know. It's, imagine people were having these exact same conversations in like the buddy, you know, 80s, 70s, or whatever, when we were moving and evolving with technology and different forms of media or whatever. Like, television comes in, the movie industry is like, oh God. But I am kind of just, it's a curious time to be around.
Yeah, well, the thing is like that, like, yeah, I imagine, yeah, every previous decade would have mentioned whatever the big changing of the guard is. Never before, though, as far as I can think of, have we changed the fundamental transactional model at the heart of it. Like, that's the big change now. And then the idea of you pay one monthly fee and you get a selection of games, and you're assuming that they're curated, you know, to give you sort of things that are worthwhile. And if that model doesn't work, and then you have to increase the monthly amounts because that doesn't fund the titles in the right way, which, I mean, there's a lot of crossover with the TV models and the movie models, where Netflix keep raising their prices. Disney Plus have gone up like three times this year. And it's just like, is that actually going to work out? I think the assumption was that they would lead with a lower price point and millions of people would come on board and it would sort itself out over time, but that just hasn't happened. The general model I see people doing now with the monthly services is rotate through them. Like, people have like one or two active at a time and then they just rotate. And it's like, at the minute I have everything, but I'm going to start being a rotator. Like, I see that way more often now. And it's like, you save up the things you want to get. Like, our own Sai does it. Like, she'll wait and be like, okay, I want to watch Castlevania and Fall of House of Usher or whatever, so I'll get Netflix for a month and I'll do all of it that month. And that, to me, that does make more financial sense than just sort of sitting on it every month. And I wonder whether that's taken hold as well. But like, fundamentally, that transactional model is the thing that's changed, I think. And it's like, it's not unless you get someone like Sony putting so much marketing money into Spider-Man 2 that you don't have those big events, like you said, whether you're playing at midnight or you're picking it up on the launch day or whatever. But yeah, what are the biggest conversation in gaming? That is like the big overall thing is, what the hell model does customers actually want from their games? And then how does that match up with the budget and the expectations? But yeah, just an interesting thing to throw in from the French outlet Ludostre. But yeah, also, you mentioned before AI stuff in games. This is the next big talking point. People might have heard of a game called The Finals. This is made by a bunch of ex-Battlefield devs, and it is ostensibly just a big competition sort of, what hell would you call it?
Reality, like, game show focused, themed, like FPS with lots of destruction and stuff. Gameplay-wise, it's very impressive, speaking as a Battlefield fan.
Yeah, yeah. If you're a fan of the term Levolution, there's a lot of that sort of stuff. Or Red Faction's old geomod technology, where you can bring a literal building or the roof down on top of someone.
Great hammer in that game. Are we doing a list on the best hammers in video games?
Best hammers? No, we've done best shotguns.
Mate, we need to do best hammers. Best Gravity hammer? The Red Faction hammer?
Oh my god, from Halo. Yeah, the big gravity hammer. That's a big shout. You've also got Thor's hammer as well.
Yeah,
we might have to do best hammer.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
God of Hammers. But yeah, so the finals is a big Battlefield type thing, very much very tech focused, very much showing off what you can do when you sync together all that destructive tech at once. And it looks really, really awesome. A lot of very good buzz around it. Apparently the Steam version, the PC version has maxed out its servers. That many people are trying to play it. However, one of the realities of getting it over the finish line has been relying on AI voice work. And it sounds terrible. It's blown up amongst, obviously, a lot of the developing community, a lot of the voice actors, etc. And this is written by IGN, who brought across some of the quotes from audio designer Andreas, who doesn't have a full name. He's just called Andreas, saying that we use AI with a few exceptions. So all the contestant voices, like the Barks and both our commentators, are AI text-to-speech. For things that we call vocalizations, like player breathing, vaulting, jumping, etc., that's something we use us in the studio to record, just grunting. We can't get the AI to perform those kind of tasks yet. Now,
can't replace a classic.
No, apparently not. Apparently not right now. So you had various various actors have weighed in on this. But voice actor Kit Harrison, who's in Ghost Runner 2, which just came out, said, what really sticks with me is that they needed to bring in real actors to get the grunting, effort, and breathing sounds because the AI can't do it. It can't replicate the noise that I make when I stand up from my chair, but it wants to take my job. Don't make me laugh. This is a whole thing. Like, I tell you, I was mentioning to you before we started recording that one of the low-key terrifying things that I've seen recently is the Google Pixel advert.
Don't get me started.
And I know that saying that out loud is going to trigger the algorithm to show me it after I've done this podcast, but in that thing, they have a program called One Take or True Take or something like that. And you can take a photo of someone, and even if they're not looking at the lens, it AI fixes it so they are. And it's almost like the horror movie Smile, where everyone suddenly does the most forced smile at the camera. And I was like, oh, this is just in a mainstream advert. This is just out there. A level of acceptance has now been forced upon people. And like, I don't know, that kind of freaked me out. Like, there's a wider conversation about AI implementation in video games, but thoughts on all this
it's
stuff.
It's just a complete lack of being able to have a candid moment, isn't it? Like, I hate that advert because, like, it's literally a case of you've taken an imperfect moment and that is what life is. Like, it should be imperfect. Like, I'll go into a whole thing with that. I really, AI as a topic is something that really boils my blood. Specifically for something like this, which, you know, I don't want to be particularly nasty to people on this podcast, but it is truly hack behavior from these developers to say that, or to even make the argument, like to embrace AI in this form, because it is putting people, like it's putting actors out of a job. And having listened to the audio, Scott Telford.
Oh, they're terrible.
There is no sense of cadence. It is absolutely stupid. And the fact that they're like, oh, we would have used it for the grunts, but we can't do that. And like just that in itself really frustrates me. And it frustrates me the most of all here because I feel like AI as a force in creativity, most of that push has come from people on social media who I kind of feel are really bitter and jealous about people who are talented. And they look at something being created and they look at that and go, well, that needs to be replaced because I can't do it. And it, rather than something that's like looking at that and thinking about all the hours and dedication and training and whatever that someone has put into, you know, make their craft and do it properly. For me, it comes across as overly like cynical, just bitter, jealous kind of, I can create this ridiculous AI creature and look at how good it is. And usually 9 times out of 10, it looks terrible anyway.
Yeah.
So for the fact for this to come from actual video game developers who are making a game or whatever, that to me is so depressing because you should have, as a game developer, an idea of like, well, I want to use the word camaraderie here, but even just collaboration. Like, you are literally, like, voice actors here are integral to the experience being developed.
Yes.
It sounds appalling. It sounds terrible. And it does make me, if I was a voice actor, I mean, we do voiceovers in our job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I kind of get a little bit anxious when I'm looking at like a TikTok or an Instagram reel where it's like, here is the AI voice. And I feel like we're being conditioned as people to accept stupid AI text-to-speech. And like, obviously text-to-speech has really vital uses, you know, for like people with like disabilities and stuff like that, that I'm not railing against that.
No, of course.
But what I'm getting at here is when it is like, we are normalizing and accepting this and taking work away from people, and it doesn't even sound good. And
no.
I still think, yeah, ultimately it's just shocking to me that this is coming from like actual video game developers, because to me, like, I don't think they need to rely on this as well. If you can't get voice actors in your game, then don't have voice actors. You should budget for this stuff.
Yeah. So my thing is just like how much it's always case by case. Like, I think it's when it feels fundamentally dehumanizing, or you're extracting the humanity from what should have been a collaborative effort. It was like, because a couple of the things that came to mind when you were talking was Lord of the Rings Gollum used ChatGPT to generate their apology. And it's like, that's just hilarious. I mean, the state of that thing, of course. Another example was Cyberpunk 2077. I forget the name of the character. It's the guy, it's the Ripper Doc that helps you out at the very, very beginning. That actor passed away. CDPR said they had enough voice lines from that guy to make a voice pack, and then they signed that off with the family to do more stuff with him. That's an interesting test case as to... I'm weird with that stuff, because it's always just like, what would he have wanted you to
do? When do we let people go? I mean, again, yeah, like, exactly, I can't speak because I don't know who that voice actor is. I'm not involved in the development. Obviously, it would be way more emotional for people involved in that game, and they got the family's permission and stuff. But this comes down to the fact that, like, I know James Earl Jones has literally signed off to have his voice to use for Darth Vader for a while. But, like, back in 2008, we had a guy who voiced Darth Vader fine as an impression, and it didn't, like, it's the inability to, like, you know, keep people as digital constructs and turn them into brand rather than people, like, yeah, but sorry for interrupting.
No, absolutely, man. I think like, again, like, it's one of those big conversations, because another thing as well is that, like, I use AI every day, like a lot of people do, and they just don't realize it. Like, a lot of the and as a tool as well, like, and it should be a tool. I remember the conversation when SpeedTree was introduced into gaming way back in like 2007 2008, the idea that you could click a button and generate a forest, and there was a similar conversation then about like, oh, but shouldn't we be designing every single part of this? And then it was all the different parameters that you could input into SpeedTree to generate environments, because it's just such a labor-intensive thing to design an entire open world when you could just give it a first pass and then go in and tweak it from there. And the philosophy is quite similar to where we're at now in terms of, like, it depends on what the utility is. But I remember that conversation as well. And SpeedTree was a bit of a thing, not for that long, but it was a similar conversation. And now it's just accepted. If you're making an open world game, you're making something that needs a lot of forestation, you can generate those forests, you can generate that stuff. Same with various other parts of landscapes as well. And that's a tool. And like I said, I use it every day because we use Photoshop all the time, like for the thumbnails on the YouTube and everything. There are content fill algorithm stuff in there, like, and it's only gotten better over time. One of the reasons that this thing kicked off so much is because you can pick any space on an image and just say fill this, and I'm hand making 99% of what we do, but if I'm filling in the corner of an image or whatever it is, I can just hit the button and generate it, and it's easier than it just saves me 5-10 minutes of my day or whatever. And so that thing of like using AI to boost the overall vision, I'm more fine with that. It's just always going to be case
by case. That's it as a tool, isn't it? It's augmentation. Mm. You are helping someone be more, if you want to boil it down to the pure cold capitalism, you're making someone more efficient at their jobs, aren't you? Like,
you know,
someone would have designed different trees and like put them on. Like that, I understand that. For me, it's literally like it's excising the human element entirely and replacing it. And the idea that it doesn't sound bad is baffling to me.
Yeah, and it's like, for me, like the weird talking point, which obviously isn't game related, but it was that Pixlaver where I just sort of realized, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was going to be something else that would reveal, like, you know, the ongoing conversation about AI, but it was like, nah, Google's just pushing ahead with this stuff. And then you have it in various video games, and it is a big talking point. I think it's weird. Just the people who actively advocate for it, like the general, and I'd be fascinated to talk to those people. Like, it's, and I get the weird sort of sci-fi bent to it, where if you've been brought up on certain movies or certain visions of sci-fi futures, you're like, oh, look how cool this is. And it's like, I don't personally think it's cool. I'm like, oh, I guess look what this particular piece of software or algorithm can spit out. Look at that. But the second you start saying it's more important than an actual human life, that's weird.
The thing that I get from the big AI advocates, and I'm talking about AI in art here, is that it's always got a kind of malicious intent behind it. Yeah, yeah. There is always some sort of thing like, I did this, and like, we can replace artists, and we can do this, and, you know, it only took me X amount of hours, and I made this this thing, and blah, blah, blah. It always, when actual artists respond to that with anxiety, and they're met with, like, you know, frothing anger from, like, the AI people, it all just comes across to me as being, like, I don't know. It feels, I can't imagine wanting to do a pursuit in life, Scott, that I wanted to half-ass. Like, if I wanted to tomorrow really get back into doing drawing again, because I did that when I was younger and then I kind of lost a passion for it, I wouldn't go, okay, I'm going to get this AI software that I'll put a prompt in and it'll draw for me.
I'm going to say the word landscape
and
sunset.
And claim it is mine. Like, that to me is baffling. There's no endeavor there. There's no there's no whatever. And like, same as writing. Like, I love writing when I get into the right headspace. Once you breaking down the wall can be hard sometimes. But again, like, I can't imagine, I don't understand this, the creative satisfaction. And to me, I think it's just non-creative people treating art as if it's a maths problem. And not something that, and again, that boils into even larger conversations that we've got, like, politically at the moment, with the idea of, like, humanities subjects being devalued, the idea of, like, science and technology and maths being, like, the big focus in schools or whatever. It's an act of cultural vandalism. Like, it genuinely is.
The thing is, like, that idea of, like you said, like, trying to quantify quality, trying to put numbers into expression, like, that is so endemic of where we're at across the board. We mentioned so many TV and movie models before, Netflix and everything else. David Zaslav and Bob Iger being in charge so much and for so long does commodify and make numerices out of expression. And it's like, but you see them all fail. Like, it's one of those things where it's always, oh, you can't fight progression, you can't fight progress. And that's always an interesting conversation, because it has to be retrospective. When we're in the moment, there's all the space to push back on certain things. Like, NFTs for their 1 month in the sun, it was like, oh my God, this is the future of, for the same people, that's the future of ownership. Oh my God, this is what this is. Power to the people, everything else. Completely failed, completely went away because it wasn't progress. And it's just one of those things where, is AI implementation the actual thing that sticks, or is it just the weird thorny conversation for now? I imagine it'll settle in the way that it has for over a decade now, where it's a tool to help artists. Because as someone, like I said, who makes artwork all day long, or is part of my job, it is just easy to click a button and fill that background thing in. But I'm not replicating the angle, the bulk of what I'm putting out there. It has to still feel human. I just don't know if it's just my general complete personal thoughts on it, but I'm too humanist. I'm too in love with the natural world. I care too much about living things to care about a synthetic replacement. I chemically do not care about that. I can't.
Yeah, I completely agree. And for what, for what it's worth, with this game, I'm not going to be checking it out at all. I would have been interested, but I will not be looking at it if this AI thing is like a regular feature. And then, to be fair, the guy's put he's shown his ass to everyone here by saying, oh, you know, we would have done it for grunts, but we couldn't even do that. So clearly there's no moral quandary for him with implementing these things. It's not even like it's a placeholder or anything. So that, to me, shows their attitudes to artists. So I am completely out.
That's completely fair. I've already played it, but it was, one, it was before I read the rest of this stuff. And the thing is, like, the way that game is presented, because it is like a big over-the-top game show, I found so much of it to be quite discordant anyway. And the cadence, like you said, and the voice acting and everything, it is very just phoned in 101. I kind of thought that's what they were going for, but it seems like they're trying to do it genuinely rather than ironically. But yeah, gameplay is solid enough, but I think it is a fascinating talking point, especially with this many people playing it. How many people notice, for one, and then how many people, like, does it kind of succeed elsewhere, kind of thing? Because that's at the heart of it. I like the idea of a bunch of ex-developers of a major corporation breaking off and doing their own thing, and it's like, that's kind of a whole other wrinkle to it as well. Next big old talking point is Dead Space 3. Interview with writer and co-producer Chuck Beaver, saying that they weren't allowed to make a horror game from the beginning from EA. And if given the choice, he would redo the entire project if given the chance. And this is written up over on Eurogamer. Beaver said that he would keep the lore that you find out in the game and have partner Ellie there, but in a different relationship with Isaac. But he would redo the entire main story. And reiterates that the team weren't allowed to make a horror game from the beginning. So the plan with what they ended up doing was trying all these different things that would expand into other gameplay genres, but all those bits together not only didn't generate a new audience, but they lost the old audience too. Just a talking point around Dead Space. I finished Dead Space 3. There are parts of Dead Space 3 that I genuinely love, but I there's bits of it that are completely abysmal. I know you've not played it, but like general, because you played 1 and 2,
yeah,
general
two.
Thoughts on
one and two,
the
yeah.
state of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad, isn't it? I think I remember this being a massive talking point. Was it 2012? Oh, yeah. 2013?
2012, I think, yeah.
I remember this being a huge thing at the time, and it did feel so aberrant given the tone and direction of the previous two games. I mean, I'm always there for co-op experiences, but it definitely felt more like Army of Two. Than Dead Space, and yeah, the fact that they were given that directive from EA, I mean, what else can you say? It's just another case of like people having a thing and not knowing what the thing was made for.
Such a Chase Gears of War. Everything was Chase COD for a bit, but it was Chase Gears as well. Just Mass Effect. Just put more of cover system stuff into it. Make it more like Gears. Make it more action-y. Mass Effect 3 and Dead Space 3 are two of the worst examples of that. And obviously they're both EA and both shook out in much the same way with the devs not being allowed to do the thing they wanted to do. Mass Effect 3 has millions of other issues too, but still, Dead Space 3's case, it's interesting because right now they've just remade Dead Space 1 early this year and it went down really, really well as a sort of like solid modernization of what went before. But even I think it's a fascinating test case as a remake because they added voice acting, they changed the level layouts, they added different systems to it in terms of like where you want to spend your power as you go through the levels. You can choose to have lights on or you can choose to have a motion sensor or whatever it is. And I was like, that's a great innovation for a horror, survival horror game. And obviously the conversation is, do they do Dead Space 2 and 3? And a lot of the rumors at the minute are that they won't overhaul them because Dead Space 2 and 3 are more modern anyway, and you would just maybe uptick the graphics or whatever. But if you've got one of the writers and co-producers saying, look, I would redo it, I wonder if, because Dead Space 1 sold so much, it was a £70 game from EA, you know, do they end up kind of course-correcting and doing the version they should have done because we're in a different time now?
That's a fascinating question, isn't it? Because, I mean, we've had like solo remakes. We've not had like to be fair, Resident Evil stands out as the other series of remakes. So yeah, I mean, Resident Evil's laid the groundwork for this. So, I mean, I think if it sold well and people love Dead Space 2, it makes sense to do that. And then they can look back at Dead Space 3, maybe right their wrongs. Yeah, I think that would make plenty of sense. There's more impetus for that remake than most other remakes that have been, you know, announced or have come out.
Yeah. That's another thing. I mean, this is like a general idea. I don't know where you come down on this, but for me, the more disastrous the attempt, the more like value there is in potentially course correcting it. If there was something there in the first place, if there was a soul there that's worth sort of resurrecting or whatever. Because like I said, there's bits of Dead Space 3 that I love. The very, very beginning is terrible. That's the bit where it's just a straight up Gears game. But the bit when you're in space and it's almost more open world and you're choosing which bits to go to first and which side missions to do and try and find different people to save and everything, that idea of like a more open area Dead Space is more like Arkham City, where it's like you're going to levels but you have a interconnected space. That's a really, really cool idea. And so I wonder if they would do something like that. But yeah, when you come down on like that idea of resurrecting a broken thing.
Yeah, no, I think there's if it's got a cool premise behind it, then absolutely go for it. Because we know all too often in this industry that games are a lot on plenty of occasions haven't been given enough time to really flesh out and you know, come out and be the best thing that they were. We've had a lot of, you know, the last generation of consoles, I feel, was very much like the story of the video game comeback. You think of stuff like Battlefield 4, Battlefront 2, you know, I'm missing a bunch of others here, games that released in poor states but then, you know, went on to kind of turn it around and make a comeback. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. Like, I would love to see more of this happen. Like, I like games being given a second chance, and because not only does it, you know, it shows that what was there was a compelling premise behind it for existing. Writing video game injustices, that's probably like, there should just be a video game developer dedicated to that, and who like. Like lend their services to different publishers, like they're the A team of.
I was just saying, like the bunch of EMTs.
Yeah. Like it's just, you know, they've got like the cigar going everywhere as well.
And the thing is, like with the likes, obviously the big two are No Man's Sky and now Cyberpunk. And even Cyberpunk was like written off. It's like there's no way you can bring this thing back. It's just so disastrous. Even though I always love that game, but I get it. But it's one of those things where if you were in those planning meetings saying like, look, as soon as we announce a Dead Space 3 remake, the general response is going to be, oh God, get it away from me. That was terrible in the first place. But then navigating that marketing and just saying, we're making a Dead Space 3 for a new audience and whatever, and then pointing to the biggest catastrophes that were overturned. Like I would love that.
So we're getting to the point now in the Resident Evil remake series where we're getting to the games that were kind of more divisively received.
Yeah.
we're certain we're going to get a Resident Evil 5 and 6 remake?
Well, that's the thing, right? I was talking to Si about this, because like I want them to... Because the thing with those new remakes is that they've unified the timeline. They've unified the tone as well. Like, obviously, they've got retrospect, they've got hindsight, so they have a way of doing, okay, this is what we should have always done kind of thing. And I think Resident Evil 3 is like a massive disappointment, mainly because it just does feel like glorified DLC. But RE4 is incredible. And it's one of those things where I think you could do an RE5 with most of the tone that RE4 like sort of changed around. Like the new RE4 is nowhere near as goofy as the original, even though it does have those elements in there too. And so like 5 and 6 is the one that I really want to see redone, because I think 6 has some great ideas in there. Like there are so many different characters you play as. They all play differently, and they're all tapping into different strands of what was RE's identity at the time, which felt like Capcom's way of just saying, we have no idea what we are anymore. We've chased Gears of War too much with like 5 and the cover shooting stuff, but then we also do survival horror with Leon. And so like I want them to try 6 again. I don't know what you do for Jake Wesker's stuff where he just punches zombies in the face, but they can maybe figure it out. But yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good thing to hold up as well, because where Resident Evil is in the remake timeline, it's right on the cusp of when they effed it up last time. And so like I hope they do at least RE5. And just commit to what
I just need to see that boulder punching redone, man. I want to see, because you have to commit to the bit. There's no way you, like, I feel like if you do like a snarky DMC hair-esque joke with that, it's not going to land. Just commit to the boulder. Commit to the boulder, man. Commit to it.
Well, the thing that new Chris Redfield is like a tank, so it kind of makes more sense, because he was inflated between like old.
Introduce
the
backstory. Was like, I trained for years to beat my ultimate opponent. My parents were killed in a boulder accident or something like that. And these.
The thing is, like, at the end of RE4, like in the original, they show Wesker, and like I think he's way more in the Separate Ways DLC where you play as Ada Wong. I've not done that yet, but they clearly are going forward with something. So it's like, yeah, that's going to be another test case. And if EA wants to be safe about it, then they can hang back and see how people respond to the announcement of a remake of RE6, because it seems like that's the direction we're going in. But yeah, fascinating stuff in regards to course correcting or going with things that were so trend chasey at the time and then trying to do a more considered version of it now. For now, though, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tailford. That's been Ewan Patterson.
Boing!
Massive thank you to all of you for listening, and we'll catch you very soon. Goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.